22-2897 CR State versus, is it Dielke or Dielke? Dielke. And we will hear first from the State of Wisconsin. Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Kathleen Potasik, appearing on behalf of the State. Your Honors, this morning the State is asking this Court to reverse the Court of Appeal decision in this case. The State is asking this Court to apply both the analysis and the remedy set forth in this Court's decision in State v. Robinson to hold that the State was properly permitted by the trial court to go back to earlier OWI drunk driving cases to reinstate and pursue charges against Mr. Dielke when he had successfully collaterally attacked prior drunk driving convictions in a later case that was his fifth offense OWI case. The State respectfully submits that the Court of Appeals made several errors in its decision. The Court of Appeals, in paragraph 13 of its decision, stated, quote, Dielke cannot be deemed to know that, in exchange for potentially lesser penalties, he was providing the later use of his convictions for enhancement purposes. As the State showed in its briefs in this case, the rulings in, for instance, State versus Banks, State versus Schumann, indicate that the drunk driving penalty enhancement scheme provides ample notice to drivers to conform their conduct to avoid enhanced penalties in future cases. Therefore, at the time Dielke entered his pleas in his prior 1993 and 2000 cases, he was indeed deemed to know that those pleas would permit enhanced penalties in any future drunk driving prosecution. The State also asserts that the Court of Appeals erred where it refers in paragraphs 15 and 16 and 21 of its decision to the benefits the State received, and therefore the Court of Appeals essentially concluded that the State had received all the benefits it bargained for once Dielke had served his sentences, paid his fines, and performed the other requirements of the pleas. The State submits that by collaterally attacking and avoiding, evading, and denying the full force and effect of the penalty-enhancing value of the OWI second and OWI fourth convictions in the enhanced sentencing proceeding of his OWI fifth case, Dielke had indeed not performed fully under the pleas entered in the two earlier cases, because as a matter of law, the enhanced penalty scheme provides that drunk driving defendants who continue to drive drunk will receive enhanced penalties. And that was a benefit that accrued as a matter of law to the State.
Ms. Potasik, let's assume for a minute that he did know about, and I think that's reasonable, that he did know about the idea of enhanced penalties. It seems to me that isn't the question. It seems to me the question is whether or not, as part of the plea agreement and as part of entering his plea, he promised in some way, explicitly or implicitly, that he would never collaterally attack those convictions. How do you get over that?
Your Honor, that is not essential to the State's argument. As this Court ruled in Robinson, when Robinson brought a successful appeal from his conviction for what were deemed multiplicitous charges after he was convicted pursuant to a plea, that permitted the vacation of the pleas and reinstatement of the pre-plea charges, regardless of the fact that there was no term in the Robinson plea agreement that Robinson would not later bring a multiplicity challenge to his convictions. Therefore, it's not essential that there have been an express term in the 1993 and 2000 cases that Dilkey not collaterally attack these convictions. Indeed, as the decision in Rivest shows, where an implicit part of the agreement is breached or repudiated, that also permits the reinstatement remedy.
Well, don't they try and distinguish Robinson?
Well, the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, tried to distinguish Robin in several ways. On one basis, it says in paragraph 20 that, Robinson had not started serving his sentence. The state submits that the decision in Rivest controls this issue because in Rivest, where it was found that Rivest gave perjurious testimony where he had agreed in his plea bargain to give testimony, the court ruled that even though Rivest had begun serving a sentence on a lesser charge, that, in the court's view, was of no consequence in determining whether a breach had occurred. So that basis on which the Court of Appeals attempted to distinguish Robinson fails. Also, as I indicated earlier, the court's view that the state got all the benefits of its bargain simply isn't the case here. The prosecutor went back to the 1993 and 2000 courts to attempt to reinstate those charges, not because that was of no consequence, but of course that was central to the penalty enhancement scheme of deterrence of drunk driving in the state of Wisconsin. Counting is the hold the state has on repeat drunk drivers. Numbers are essential to the entire scheme, and when Dilkey successfully purged his earlier convictions of their penalty-enhancing value, the state fairly went back to those courts of the 1993 and 2000 convictions and asked for the reinstatement remedy that Robinson provides. Also, the Court of Appeals stated in paragraph 23 of its opinion that Dilkey could not breach a plea agreement by failing to comply with an unarticulated requirement. The state has several responses to that, one of which is the Rivest Court indicates that an implied provision of a plea agreement, which is breached, can result in a reinstatement of pre-plea charges. Further, Mr. Dilkey argued in his brief that, if you wanted to include the no collateral attack provisions in the plea, all you had to do was do that at the time. But that argument, the state submits, would make no sense under conditions where Dilkey is arguing he was deprived of counsel in the 1993 and 2000 cases, and it would be presumed that under circumstances where he lacked counsel, that Dilkey would argue that even an articulated condition of that sort would fall because in the absence of counsel, the entire plea agreement is defective. What the state is asking here is merely to provide Dilkey with that which he claims he was deprived of. The state is asking to be permitted to go back to the 1993 and 2000 cases and provide Dilkey the counsel he claims he was deprived of. It's fair for all of the following reasons. It does not violate the state's remedy here does not violate the Constitution. It's consistent with this court's ruling in Robinson. And because counting is central to the plea enhancement scheme, it avoids the problem that collateral attacks raise when they are successful, and that is collateral attacks that are successful thwart and erode the plea enhancing scheme, where the state chooses to go back and reinstate charges and pursue them in a counsel setting or in a setting where the attorney waiver is sufficient. It's only fair that the state be permitted to do that. And it's also, yes.
Counsel, I look at this as a contract, and I assume that's the appropriate analysis. Is that correct?
This court has concluded in Robinson that contract principles do apply.
And if this, you're saying there is an implicit provision in this contract, and that's your argument. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And it seems to me that a provision in a contract, explicit or implicit, by its nature is one that can be bargained for by both sides. Am I wrong or am I right on that?
Well, I think by its nature an implicit condition would be one that isn't express, and therefore whether I think there might be disputes over whether it was bargained for or whether, and the state is arguing that as a matter of law here, it is indeed implicit.
And it can never be bargained for?
In this case, we have stated that the prosecution cannot bargain it away, therefore it is implicit as a matter of law in every OWI plea agreement. It's what the law provides. The prosecutor cannot bargain it away, and it will count in the next time that the defendant drives drunk and is convicted, unless under these circumstances he does bring a collateral attack claiming the earlier conviction was constitutionally infirm. That we are not suggesting Hahn was inappropriately decided. All we are saying is that when a successful collateral attack is brought, it's fair to give the state a chance to give the defendant what he claims he was deprived of, and then to go forward. And the roadmap that Robinson provides gives the two exceptions to the state, the remedy the state is suggesting here. And again, it all goes to fairness. What Robinson states is there are two exceptions to the rule, and I'm going to quote the paragraph 48 of Robinson, where the court said that ordinarily where a defendant successfully challenges a conviction resulting from a plea bargain, or here I would suggest where the consequences of a conviction resulting from a plea bargain are challenged, the remedy should be, and now I quote, to reverse the conviction, vacate the negotiated plea agreement upon which the conviction was based, set aside the amended information, and reinstate the original charges against the accused. Now, in the next paragraph, the court states there are exceptions to this. And these exceptions are, first, whether the remedy adversely affects the ability to prosecute or defend the original charges. And the state submits that on this record, there is no indication that either the prosecution or the defendant was adversely affected in this case, because Delkey, in fact, entered no contest pleas in a counseled setting. After the fact. Second, the second exception that the court states in Robinson is whether the remedy exposes the defendant to a risk of a greater sentence. And here, there can be no chance of that. The prosecutor very surgically went back and said, we don't ask for another sentence. All we're asking is to be able to count the conviction in those earlier cases as we were permitted in the first place prior to the collateral attack. So neither of the two exceptions the Robinson court articulates apply in this case, and therefore the reinstatement remedy is entirely appropriate and fair to both parties. The state also suggests that the reinstatement remedy is fair because it puts the parties in the same position they were before the collateral attack. And both parties are permitted under the state's remedy to be put in as good a position as they were in prior to the collateral attack. I'm looking also at the Robinson decision, paragraph 51, footnote 26. The court notes that in the restatement second of contracts in the provision cited there, this is another contract provision that applies, and I'm quoting, the other interests protected are the expectation interest of the promisee in having the benefit of the bargain by being put in as good a position as he or she would have been in had the contract been performed, and the restitution interest of the promisee in having restored him or her any benefit that was conferred on the other party. The state submits that one of those benefits that was conferred on the state when Delkey entered his uncounseled pleas in the 1993 and 2000 cases was that if Delkey chose to drive drunk in the future, a penalty enhancement would take place. Now that he's collaterally attacked that, it's fair for the state to go back, be put back in the position, go back to the point where the constitutional deprivation is found to have occurred, and then remedy that, cure the defect, and then go forward and reinstate those charges, not for purposes of an additional sentence, but to count them in a later case.
How broad is this case in terms of ramifications? when I was preparing for this case, I noted that the defendant interprets this case as only involving the question of whether these particular facts constitute a material breach of the plea of this plea agreement. And I also have in the back of my mind here that we're talking about Gideon violations, you know, which is, I don't want to say pretty unique, but I guess it is kind of unique these days. I mean, most people, we don't see a lot of Gideon violations in this kind of a context procedurally. But we have them, two cases, Gideon violations here. So what are the ramifications of this case? Your opposing counsel would indicate it's kind of narrow.
Well, Your Honor, in OWI cases, as the Court is aware, there have been a series of collateral attacks brought by various defendants. The Court in Hahn, which was not a drunk driving case, but indicated that the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Burgett and Custis permit collateral attacks. They are brought by drunk driving defendants. But the irony is the people with the greatest incentive to bring these collateral attacks are the people with the most horrendous records, the people who are true menaces on the roads, the people who knew for however many years that they didn't have a lawyer in that prior circumstance, but wait until they get an advanced charge of, say, an OWI fifth, which exposes them to felony penalties. For the first time, these drivers then may bring this up. These are the people with the greatest incentives. And what we're asking for is only the fairness of being permitted to go back and give him what he says he was deprived of. Where he says he had a Gideon violation in the earlier case, we say put both parties back in their pre-plea position, permit him to get a lawyer, permit him to give a sufficient attorney waiver if that's what he chooses to do, and then go forward again. And if he is acquitted, and this can happen when pleas are vacated and charges are reinstated, well, then that's what happens. But this is the fairness remedy that Robinson provides and that the state seeks here and that the trial court properly granted.
The thing that bothers me is that it does sound fair. And in Robinson, they needed the two convictions in order to get the sentence they wanted, the state thought was deserving. And so when the defendant knocks out one of those charges, then the concepts of the sentencing seem to have gone by the wayside in Robinson. This case, though, I suggest, might be broader than the defendant, because if we do what you suggest, we're saying contract principles apply. There is no express provision in this contract relating to collateral attack or on appeal, right? So if we're going to say there's a violation of the contract, we first have to fix up the contract. The court has to then say that the contract is not express, but that the court's going to read terms into the contract. The court did that in the truthful testimony case. I've now forgotten. What is it, Rivets? Yeah, Rivets. Court read it in. On the other hand, to say that you're going to testify by definition means you have to be truthful because you know there's going to be an oath. So that didn't bother me. In Robinson, it disturbed the entire concept of the penalty and what was happening. So you had an underlying you had an underlying failure to meet the minds, and it seemed gone to me. I wrote Robinson, but looking back at it. In this case, I think your argument is it's the same kind of failing of the minds to meet, because the underlying concept of the state is that it's going to be used later on. I just have a little more trouble recognizing that as the underlying basic concept. So my real point of this and the question I have for you is, once the court starts or once the court continues reading factors into the contract, where's the stopping point? We will go on and on and on, and it means that, and not only the state can trip the agreement, but the so can the defendant. I mean, this happens to be the state saying, state's been fooled. Not fair to the state. Next time it's going to be the defendant. And so what you're doing is really upsetting, potentially by your implicit agreement argument, many plea agreements.
Your Honor,
why shouldn't the state just put it in? I mean, you guys know what the score is. Put it in.
Your Honor, under these circumstances where the only collateral attack pursuant to the Hahn decision that can be brought by a drunk driving defendant is a violation of a Sixth Amendment right, lack of counsel, under these circumstances, putting it in, I think, would effectively get wiped out by the claim, well, I didn't have a lawyer when I agreed to that, so therefore you can't bind me to that. I just don't see how it would apply in these circumstances. Also, in terms of how broad this would go, I think the Rives decision indicates that these are in terms of that these implied conditions have to be fairly decided on a case-by-case basis. In that case, you're suggesting that perjury was a bedrock of the judicial system. We're suggesting here that the penalty-enhancing value of drunk driving offenses is the bedrock of the drunk driving deterrence scheme in the state of Wisconsin. I don't think it has to go broader than that under these circumstances. I believe that as a matter of law, it's part of that agreement by legislative fiat, and therefore it's only fair to permit the state to go back. The state didn't pull the wool over Robinson's eyes. And I suggested in the brief, too, that the Robinson contract analysis of a mistake of law is, I think, provides guidance here, because at the time he entered the plea agreements, it appears from the record that both the defendant and the state were under the mistaken notion that these were constitutional convictions. And so many years later, or a few, or perhaps 1 year later, depending on which conviction you're looking at here, Mr. Delkey claims, wait a minute, I was deprived of a lawyer. Well, okay, you can do that, but now let us go back and fix what you say was broken. So this is limited to these circumstances under this drunk driving scheme, under the Rives decision.
But I don't quite understand exactly what the effect of the collateral attack was. Did it totally wipe out the convictions?
Your Honor raises a question that I think would essentially have to be remedied in this case. Here, Mr. Delkey insisted that those OWI convictions remain of record. And even though the prosecutor suggested on the record at the hearings after the collateral attack that he wanted Delkey to withdraw his pleas, and the defense attorney said, no, he wishes to keep those of record. You've still got those convictions. And, of course, the result is here we've got these OWI convictions remaining of record, but they don't count for anything. I think where the prosecutor has said, I don't think we can force him to withdraw his pleas, I think actually the Robinson decision tells us that once you do avoid, evade, and deny the force and effect of these drunk driving penalty enhancements of these prior convictions, that the plea ought to be vacated and then go back. Now, here, I don't know that the record would need to be changed in the state's view. He's got an OWI conviction. He's got a PAC conviction now in both cases, prohibited alcohol concentration conviction. And because there's only one conviction for counting purposes, under 346.65, that, or 346.63, that is fine here. But I think in the future, and under the state's view here, where the state prevails here, or should the state prevail, that the plea ought to be vacated, and those parts of the plea that wouldn't result in any additional sentence ought to be pursued in a subsequent case.
It just seemed to me if convictions were collaterally attacked, you can't unserve jail time that was served. But the question of fines paid, it seems to me if there's no conviction, say, I want my fine money back. But basically you're saying there's a conviction, but it's like sterile as far as, and in fact you get to keep the money.
But the defendant has sort of designed
what the rules of the conviction are.
Right. He has made a choice. He has driven this arrangement here by saying, I want the conviction to remain a record. It's essentially sterile at this point. You can't count it. And the state is saying here, well, the statutory scheme permits us to count it if we can show that it was properly charged, properly entered. And here, too, he's not attacking the initial charging decision. He's not attacking the actual OWI conviction. He's just saying, well, just don't count it. It's an odd situation, Your Honor. And in terms of the forfeiture or the fine, I hadn't thought of it. Should that part of it be, perhaps.
But your point is he's making inconsistent statements.
He is. And I think Robinson has the appropriate remedy. You vacate, and then you go forward having given him the counsel he suggests he was deprived of.
Go ahead.
Justice Bradley, and then Justice Rogenczak.
So if this goes back to trial, let's say his 1993 conviction, that was a charge in 1993, and for some reason, maybe because of staleness, the state can't prove its case. As a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question, how do you then give back the fine he paid and in some ways try to ameliorate the time he served?
I hadn't thought about it much at all before this in terms of the returning of the fine. As a matter of fairness, perhaps that's the case. Let me put it this way. It seems to me that if he's acquitted, the fine would go back. In terms of if the state does not go back to reopen, I don't think it happens. Your Honor, I don't think it happens because what Robinson says is that the exceptions to the Robinson rule that I'm advancing here is that the exceptions are whether the remedy adversely affects the ability to prosecute or defend. If Delkey had interposed an objection to the prosecutor's rule here that says, I can't defend this, there's no records, or we can't get the witnesses or whatever, he might have had an argument to say, nope, you can't apply the Robinson rule because there is that obstacle here. And in those cases, I think everything just sits because then the prosecutor doesn't get to go back and vacate. It just sits, which is what's happening now prior to this approach that was taken in Delkey.
Go ahead. Justice Rogenczak, you had a question?
I had a question. My understanding was that he was charged with OMBWI and PAC. He got convicted on the OMBWI on a plea, and then when the objection was made under the Sixth Amendment, they went back and convicted him under the PAC, right? So that's why the money is there.
Yes.
And why the penalties and everything are the same is because nothing different was applied as a remedy for that second conviction for the PAC. Am I right on the record?
That's correct. The judgment says no additional penalty in either one or both of those cases, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I just wanted to be sure I understood.
That was my point. In this case, the trial court held for the state. Therefore, it was opened. He had to plea again. He pled, if I remember it, no contest.
Correct, Your Honor.
So what happened was the conviction was reinstated in effect. The same sentence was there. And what happened was the state at the trial court in this case cleaned up the lack of counsel because he pled now with counsel.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
So his objection here is he wants the new convictions erased because they're based on a bad, in his opinion, order vacating the first conviction. So all of this is not really relevant in this particular case because he pled again. He didn't ask for a trial.
Right. And that's why the record doesn't indicate there was any obstacle to defending or to prosecuting.
And he pled no contest.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Pasek. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. McKnight.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court, good morning. Kelly McKnight, and I represent the defendant in this matter, Robert Delkey. And just as a point of clarification, given the context of the questioning that was going on at the end of the State's presentation, what actually happened here is Mr. Delkey was charged in a 2001 OWI fifth, and motions were brought to collaterally attack his prior convictions, which were all granted. The State then sought to and the collateral attacks, the function of those was that while these convictions remained of record, he'd been convicted of them, he'd paid his fines, he'd done his alcohol assessment, he'd served his jail sentences, he'd had his driver's license revoked. All of those things, those penalties, remained in effect, and the conviction remained of record with a valid judgment of conviction in the clerk of court's office. The judgment of conviction wasn't expunged, it wasn't removed. If you look at his criminal record, there was still a record there that he'd been convicted of an OWI. The practical application was that these convictions could no longer be used to enhance the penalty in his fifth offense OWI that was pending at a later time in a different branch, which functionally dropped the penalties on that conviction. The State then moved to vacate the plea agreements in those underlying OWI convictions. And the motion by the State actually wasn't to vacate the plea agreements in their entirety, but rather just to vacate the charges that had been dismissed in those cases. And the Court granted that request, and so I believe it was the prohibited alcohol concentration charges, which had been dismissed, were reinstated. Mr. Delkey pled to those, and because for both the reasons that he had already paid his fines, served his sentences, etc., and because the statute provides that only one judgment of conviction can exist, he was not fined, he wasn't penalized in any other way. The state simply sought to get around the issue of Mr. Delkey not having counsel on his convictions in 1993 and 2000.
So the judge, who's now, let's say, arguably presented with a sentence for an OWI third schematic, if you will, rather than an OWI fifth, is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
And a judge, I suppose, on an OWI third, of course, we all know that there's maximums and minimums and leeways. I mean, the court could take into consideration the prior. Well, let me ask. I mean, can the court take into consideration that this guy really has a drinking problem? And if the court makes the appropriate record, give him the max on OWI third here?
Well, that's certainly an interesting question. I mean, it's obviously by eliminating the penalty enhancement purposes of those prior convictions, it's no longer a felony because the maximum penalties go down. But there's still a penalty range, and while there's statutory guidelines for what penalties should be imposed, the court still has whatever sentencing discretion it would have in any other case. And it certainly, I think, would, if it stated the appropriate reasons for doing so, be able to exercise that discretion in any way that it saw fit. And if that meant giving the maximum penalties in terms of fines and jail time and license revocation, I certainly think that it could do so. That, of course, opens a whole other box in that on those convictions that and I assume this is what you're talking about, on those underlying convictions, if the court were to allow those underlying convictions to be reopened, there's no guarantee that the court's going to give the same sentence that was given the first time around. And someone who got the guideline minimum penalties on, say, a second offense drunk driving, collaterally attacks those, and you know, pending what this court does today, if the state is allowed to reopen those prior convictions, there's no guarantee that the sentencing judge, whether it's the same sentencing judge or a different sentencing judge, when that case goes back into court, gives them the statutory or guideline minimums.
But isn't that a risk he takes when he moves to vacate the plea?
He didn't move to vacate the plea.
Well, isn't that a risk that he takes when he collaterally attacks the plea?
Not under the law as it exists now. The law as it exists now provides that a collateral attack is simply an attack on the penalty enhancement value of those pleas or of those prior convictions. It doesn't directly attack the validity of the convictions. He doesn't challenge the...
Well, that's because that's your position, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the court's position.
No, I would agree with that, but that's the law as it stands today. And it's certainly is clear here that Mr. Delkey didn't move to vacate his pleas, didn't ask to vacate his pleas. He simply exercised his constitutional right as set forth in Custis and Burgett and Hahn and that line of cases that says that in an enhanced penalty proceeding, a criminal defendant has the right to challenge a conviction that was obtained in violation of his right to counsel as a penalty enhancer, not a direct attack on the conviction, not saying that the conviction itself is invalid, simply that the conviction isn't sufficiently reliable to be used as a penalty enhancer in a subsequent proceeding.
Thank you.
At any rate, that from Mr. Delkey's perspective, there are three significant problems with the state's request that this court issue a ruling that his collateral attack on his prior convictions as penalty enhancers in the subsequent case constituted breaches of the plea agreements in those previous cases. The first of these is that the defendant's actions, if you apply the law as it stands, that being Rivas and Robinson, to the facts of this case, did not constitute a material and substantial breach of the plea agreement warranting vacation of that agreement and reinstatement of the charges. The second problem with the state's position is that from a practical standpoint, this rule is a bad idea, and there are a lot of problems that are going to arise if the state is allowed to move to vacate plea agreements and reinstate charges against criminal defendants who move to collaterally attack the use of prior convictions only in an enhanced sentencing proceeding. And lastly, I would point out that this rule for collateral attack has been around since 1967 when the United States Supreme Court decided the Burgett case, and the state has been unable to point to any cases from any jurisdiction that have held that it is a violation of a plea agreement to collaterally attack a conviction for use as a penalty enhancer in a subsequent proceeding. Now, Mr. Delkey has argued throughout the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and now to the Supreme Court, that his actions in filing these collateral attacks of his prior convictions don't amount to breaches of the plea agreements in those underlying cases, that being the 1993 and the 2000 case. First, with respect to this, I would point out that, as the Court's aware, there was no prohibition in either of these plea agreements saying that he couldn't collaterally attack these convictions in the future. And had the state wanted to do that, they could have done that. They could have said, these convictions, we have to be able to use them against you in the future. And if you do anything to alter that, then you have violated the plea agreements and we can move to reopen.
Would that have been a valid agreement in light of Hahn and federal cases?
Well, that would be a valid agreement. That would be a valid agreement, I believe, in the context of cases that circuit courts see today with a heightened awareness of the collateral attack issue. And this court has seen more collateral attack cases in recent years, and I think that there are more collateral attack cases in circuit courts. I think that because of that, circuit court judges are more cognizant of the problems with not getting valid waivers of counsel, and trial courts are making efforts to obtain valid waivers of counsel. Coupled with a valid waiver of counsel, I believe an agreement to not collaterally attack a conviction in the future certainly is a valid agreement. Now, in Mr. Delkey's particular instances, would those have been valid? Strictly in terms of the meeting of the minds between the district attorney's office and Mr. Delkey, I believe so. I believe that if we were looking at this in terms of what did the plea agreement contemplate, irrespective of the right to counsel, and that's the question, is what did the plea agreement contemplate? If that would have been discussed, if the state would have said to him, you can't attack these in the future, or if it would have been even stated on the record that we're going to use these to enhance penalty in the future, that regardless of the violation of the right to counsel, that's still a valid agreement. He can move to collaterally attack them based on the violation of his right to counsel, but the plea agreement in and of itself survives independent of the violation of right to counsel. The state conceded at the trial court level that these matters were never discussed between the state and Mr. Delkey. They conceded that they weren't stated on the record. The gist of the state's argument with respect to this implicit term of the plea agreement that contemplates the use of these convictions as future penalty enhancers is really that these are the essence of the plea agreement, and because the use of these prior or these convictions in the future is the essence of the plea agreement, then anything that affects the ability to use those prior convictions then violates the plea agreement.
Counselor, was there any testimony about whether or not Mr. Delkey knew about the repeater nature of subsequent OMVWI convictions?
There was. Mr. Delkey did not testify at the hearing.
Okay, so the only thing that's in the record is just a statement from the state saying they didn't discuss the repeater nature with him, but there is no statement on whether or not he knew it independently of a lack of discussion.
That's true. I would point out, though, that at least in my opinion, whether or not he knew about those prior, the enhancement possibilities of those prior convictions isn't really central to whether or not that's part of the plea agreement. If the state wants that to be part of the plea agreement, they should make it part of the plea agreement, regardless of what the defendant's knowledge of the law is. It's similar to the rule that was set forth in State versus Klessig regarding waiver of right to counsel. It doesn't matter if a person's got 5 prior convictions where he's had a lawyer. If he's a pro se defendant, the court has a duty to go through a colloquy with him to ensure that he's waiving his right to counsel knowingly and intelligently. Likewise, the law regarding plea agreements is that they need to be stated on the record, and the court needs to ensure that the plea agreement that's stated on the record is what the plea agreement is, and the prosecutor has that responsibility too. There can't be secret terms of the plea agreement.
Yeah, but Counselor, you know, the terms are hardly secret when they're in the statute and the state has no ability to change them. Wouldn't you agree the state has no ability to change those terms?
I agree with that.
Right. And they're also set out in the statute, right?
They are set out in the statute.
I mean, I don't see how you can say that's secret. I have a little problem with that.
Well, the terms aren't – the fact that those are in the statute aren't secret. What's secret is the fact that the state is holding the defendant to this responsibility that he can't attack that conviction in the future.
No, I think what the state is saying, if you can attack it, but if you do, you know, this, and I lose on this part of the plea, then that's a material breach. I think that's what the state is saying. They're not taking away the defendant's right to attack it. I don't think that's the argument.
But they're not telling him that it's a material breach if he does so.
Well, yeah. You know, when it's in the statute and it's absolutely required of a conviction, I really have a hard time with saying that the plea and the results of the plea aren't tied together. I mean, why do you think they're not tied together?
I think that they're not tied together because what we're talking about is the meeting of the minds that the state and the defendant come to in reaching the plea agreement. If we're going to analogize this to a contract, what we need to look at is what the terms of the contract are that are negotiated.
Yeah, but you can never make a contract in violation of the law. It doesn't matter if it's civil or if it's something that is given contract terms in a criminal proceeding like this. You cannot contract in violation of the law. So the state could never have said, I'm going to accept your plea, but there's no penalty enhancement involved. You can't do that.
And so I'm not suggesting that they could. What I'm suggesting is that, look, rather than look at this in terms of can the state bargain away the right to use these as penalty enhancers in the future, I look at this as can the state bargain away the right to allow an attack on these in the future.
No, that's very different. I mean, you can attack them, but then the chips fall where the chips fall, depending on whether you're successful or not and what the results of that are. But, you know, I just have a hard time with your saying that's not a material part of the agreement when the penalty and the plea are so tied together by statute. I'm not following your reasoning. I'm sorry.
I don't know how to explain it to you any other way. And I would just reiterate that I think that the focus here needs to be on what the bargain is, what the exchange is. And I don't think it's questioned that the state has the authority and the ability to bargain with the defendant as to whether or not that defendant can attack that conviction in terms of use as a penalty enhancer in a future case. And that's regardless of whether or not the state has the ability to bargain that penalty enhancement nature away, they can bargain on what the defendant can do. And in these cases, they declined to do so. And I guess that's the only way I can distinguish that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. McKnight, the strongest argument I heard from opposing counsel was on the basis of fairness. She basically said, look, if it's fair for the defendant to be able to come in, collaterally attack these convictions and have them set aside, then it ought to be fair for the state to reinstate those charges. We ought to be able to start over. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I think there are several things wrong with that argument. First of all, I think that the concept that the state is talking about here has the potential to violate due process. What we're talking about here, at least in Mr. Delkey's case, is a 1993 conviction. And the state is saying, okay, you want us to not be able to use that 1993 conviction to enhance the penalty in your 2001 case, which is 8 years later, we're going to reopen that 1993 conviction. And if you want to go to trial on it, we'll go to trial on it, and you can have your lawyer. And if we win, then we get to use that as a penalty enhancer. Well, first of all, it's 8 years old, and it's a stale case. It's outside of the statute of limitations if the case was being charged anew. There's the potential that witnesses are going to be missing. There's the potential that whatever blood sample was taken to substantiate the prohibited alcohol concentration charge is gone. There's potential that other evidence might be lost. And with those potentials, what happens if the defendant goes to trial on that 1993 case and wins?
Those are potentials, but there wasn't any claim like that made here, if I understood opposing counsel correctly. You or whoever was representing your client at the time didn't make these claims.
That's true.
How is this case any different from State versus Robinson? State versus Robinson basically would put everybody back where they started from, but would allow some exceptions that would seem to me at least to take into account the idea of due process. Why shouldn't we take the State versus Robinson approach here?
Well, the first difference between this case and State versus Robinson is that the defendant in State versus Robinson filed a motion directly attacking the validity of one of his convictions. There were two convictions in that case. The plea agreement specifically negotiated one of the original charges down from a Class C felony to a Class D felony. and the parties agreed that they were going to plead to those, that the defendant was going to plead to those two charges to give the state 10 years of exposure if they're if the defendant were to, well, the contemplation was that he was going to be placed on probation, but the state wanted 10 years of exposure and they wanted two criminal convictions. Well, that's what they did, and based on their negotiations, the state amended one of their charges. And then the defendant turned around and said, well, one of these charges that you just amended is not now unconstitutional because it's multiplicitous, and I'm going to attack that, and I'm going to get it thrown out, and now my maximum exposure on the very case that we're talking about, the very plea agreement that we are talking about whether or not it should be vacated, my exposure has gone from 10 years to 5 years, and I now have one conviction instead of two. That's the first difference. The second difference is that, as the Court of Appeals noted, Robinson hadn't started serving his sentence. And Mr. Delkey's 2001 conviction was a fourth offense, and I don't recall off the top of my head what his penalties were, but I know that they were substantial in terms of fine and jail time. And if Mr. Delkey were to have that case reopened and he were to go to trial and win on that, as this Court's already discussed, what do you do in terms of the time that he spent in jail, the fine, the license revocation? He forfeited his vehicle. Are you going to give him his vehicle back? Are you going to hold the money that criminal defendants pay on fines in escrow until these things are done, so the state has the money, or the county, whoever has the money to pay him back? But for me, the biggest difference is that Delkey's underlying convictions in 1993 and 2001 contemplated him pleading to a charge, having an OAR dismissed, serving various penalties, and the state was relieved of their burden to prove Delkey beyond a reasonable, or guilty beyond a reasonable doubt at a trial, got their conviction, got their money, got their jail time, got Delkey off the road. And that's the essence of the agreement. The essence of the agreement in Robinson was something entirely different, and Robinson's attack on one of those two convictions totally disintegrated the basis for the plea agreement in those underlying cases, whereas the basis for the plea agreement in Delkey's cases still remain intact because he's done the things that he agreed to do in terms of his penalties, and the state has received those benefits.
That is a very, to my mind, a good explanation of the difference between Robinson and this case. But the state's position, if I understand it, is that part of its benefits it gets is by an extra conviction that progressively increases his penalties. So it's like exposure for 10 years. In this case, it means exposure to the fact that you will have a second and a fourth conviction, which ups the fifth conviction. And that penalty, although it wasn't written in and was not expressly bargained for the way it was in Robinson, was there implicitly. So the deal that the state was supposed to get was fine, so many days in jail, or whatever they ultimately agreed in, plus this counts against you, buddy, and next time you do it, and this is a recidivist kind of crime unless the alcohol problem is resolved, next time you do it, your penalties are going to go higher. That the state is, the way I hear the state is saying, that is implicit. Just like in Robinson, it was explicit. We want you to have a 10-year exposure. And when Robinson attacks one of the charges and gets it wiped out, the whole basis of the Robinson plea agreement is gone because the state lost its 10-year exposure. And the state is saying here, comparable to the 10-year exposure is that he is going to be progressively hit hard. Now, how do you answer that?
Well, I would guess I would disagree, first of all, that the two situations are comparable. The increased penalty enhancement nature of the convictions in Delkey's case are, at least in my opinion, a collateral consequence of the pleas, of the plea agreements. And one of the reasons that I say that is because if these things are so important, if this is the essence of the plea agreement, why doesn't anybody ever talk about it? Why doesn't the state talk about it? Why don't they tell Delkey in plea negotiations that the very foundation of this agreement is that you can't ever attack the use of this conviction in the future, so we can use it to enhance your penalty in future cases? Instead, what they tell Delkey is, this is the amount of jail time you're going to get, this is your fine, this is how long we're going to take your license, and we're going to take your car. And I think that that's one distinction. And the other distinction is that in Robinson and Delkey, we're talking about either an attack on convictions in the very case that the plea agreement deals with and the convictions deal with, versus in Delkey, we're talking about an attack that occurs either up to 8 years later in an entirely separate proceeding that doesn't go back. I don't understand how a collateral attack that occurs 8 years later on a second offense drunk driving, when the defendant has already done everything that he's supposed to do in accordance with his judgment of conviction and the plea agreement in that case, shakes the foundations of that plea agreement in any way. There is a collateral consequence that he is to suffer enhanced penalties for future OWIs, but this is a similar situation to the cases McMadison and James that were discussed by both the defendant and the state regarding the habitual traffic offender law. You don't have to tell a defendant when he is convicted of a drunk driving that it can be used to take his driver's license away as a habitual traffic offender. And that's because the court has said that him being a habitual traffic offender and him losing his license as a habitual traffic offender is a collateral consequence. It's in the statute, just like the enhanced penalty nature of subsequent OWI convictions are in the statute. But it's not an inherent part of the agreement. Therefore, the prosecutor doesn't have to discuss it with the defendant, and the parties aren't bound to a plea agreement that doesn't discuss that. I would just take a few minutes here to finish explaining why I don't think the state's suggested rule is a good idea, why it won't work. And I would point out that in State v. Hahn, this court discussed the need to have sort of a uniform method for courts to review other courts' decisions. And what we're talking about here, if the court were to grant the state's request, it would create problems, especially in respect to OWIs that are predicated on out-of-state convictions. What do you do with a defendant who has a fourth offense drunk driving and his three prior convictions are in Minnesota, and that defendant moves to collaterally attack those prior OWI convictions, and the state grants his request? Well, is the state of Wisconsin then going to contact the state of Minnesota and say, hey, by the way, we need to have these charges over here reopened so we can get a valid counseled plea on them? We're talking about creating really two distinct and separate ways of addressing prior OWI convictions when a defendant chooses to challenge their penalty enhancement nature. The way for the court to address Wisconsin cases where there has been an uncounseled plea and there's a record, and then the way for the court to address out-of-state cases or Wisconsin cases where there isn't a record or where the state isn't able to get the court to withdraw the plea. And it doesn't seem fair to me to say to a defendant, well, if your priors are in Wisconsin, you're out of luck because we can reopen your prior convictions, versus a defendant whose prior convictions are out of state, and you say, well, you know, I guess if you can collaterally attack those, you get to go from a fourth offense to a second offense. The last thing that I would note is that this problem that we're talking about, at least in my opinion, has some finality to it. And that is because, as I had previously indicated, courts are becoming more aware of the problem with collateral attack and with the problem with waiver of counsel. Courts, I think, are moving to take valid pleas, to be more conscious of the waiver of the right to counsel. And from the state's perspective, as I've suggested, if they want to remedy this problem, they have their own remedy. And that remedy is when they negotiate with defendants on any criminal conviction, whether it's a drunk driving, an OAR, a misdemeanor that could be used to enhance penalty as a repeater allegation in a future case, all the state has to do is say to them in plea negotiations, this is the plea agreement, you're going to serve this much jail time, and you're going to pay this fine, and part of this agreement is that you can't collaterally attack this in the future. That solves the problem. And then the defendant goes into court, and the court takes a valid waiver of the defendant's right to counsel if he or she is pro se, and problem solved. So I see this as something that has a limited term application. And I would suggest that rather than modify the law as it exists with respect to breaches of plea agreements and collateral attacks on convictions versus direct attacks on convictions, that the court simply let this situation run its course, and it's eventually going to go away. The remedy that exists is a fair remedy. It's a fair remedy to both the state and to the defendant. It balances the need to put both parties back where they would have been if the constitutional violation had never occurred, with the interest. I see my time is up.
You should finish your sentence.
Okay, with the interest of the courts and the state in having the court calendar not clogged up, and the problem that we previously discussed in terms of what happens if the defendant wins a trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to respond to some of the points that Mr. McKnight made. Mr. McKnight suggested that because courts are becoming more aware of this, that I think what he was suggesting was that attorney waiver colloquies are being put on the record more carefully. That doesn't solve the problem the state is trying to fix here, however, Your Honors. The old drunk driving convictions that may have been entered in pro se proceedings without proper attorney waivers are of record now. They exist. Again, the people with the most incentive to collaterally attack are the people with the worst records, and the solution the state provides in this case would avoid the problem of having people with artificially low drunk driving numbers driving on the roads.
Counsel, you ask that we hold the defendant to knowing the law, and that's the general rule. Everybody knows it's a little fake because none of us knows all of the law, right? But we have to have a working hypothesis, and that's it. Seems to me the working hypothesis is also that the state knows the law. And the state enters into an agreement with somebody. The state knows he is a repeater. They charge him. The state can have access to those records, the prior records, the public records. If the state had looked, it would have found there was no attorney. The state therefore knows that that conviction has deep problems for an enhancement, right?
You're talking about in the enhanced sentencing proceedings?
Yes, yes. I mean that when, and I didn't go back and check all the dates, so I'm not so sure about the 93, but by that time 2000 rolls around, they know that the state knows that the defendant is supposed to have a lawyer. And by the time 2001 rolls around and you've got a plea agreement potential, they know that the 2000 conviction has a problem and the 93 conviction has a problem. So you guys are entering into these plea agreements knowing that there is a deep problem with these agreements for purposes of enhancement. You want us to hold the defendant to understanding that he's liable progressively. You don't want to hold the state to responsibility of not doing this and of then not expecting it to hold up.
Your Honor, in the classic case, the decision was made that that the burden falls on the defendant to make a prima facie case. And it's the defendant who has to bring forward the records to show.
But you still know it.
If the defendant does, under the classic rule, if the state has available to it drunk driving convictions based on DMV records, that's what it's got. It's got convictions. It's got the DMV records. Some version of perhaps both. Until the defendant, under the classic ruling, brings forth a prima facie showing that the earlier convictions were entered with a Sixth Amendment violation. That's who's got the burden. The defendant has the burden.
Counsel, I'm wondering, again, I get to the uniqueness of, I don't know if it's unique, but were all of these prior convictions in Eau Claire County?
Yes, they were.
Yeah, that seems to me, in this day and age, not something you can count on. What happens, and I'm touching now upon the logistical problem. Opposing counsel says, what happens if the 93 conviction is from Minnesota? Well, what if these convictions, the one before us, the fifth, the one which was collaterally attacked, I mean, the one that's the most recent. But let's say that's in Eau Claire, but the 93 conviction is in Milwaukee, and then maybe, you know, people drive. Maybe the guy lived in Milwaukee but got arrested in Madison for the fourth conviction. How does that work, then? Does the Eau Claire County DA contact the Milwaukee County DA and say, we want you to open up this 1993 case and then get cooperation from the Milwaukee County DA to do that, and then contact the Madison DA? And what if they don't do that? I mean, if I were a busy DA, I'd say, Eau Claire, do your own work, you know. So how does all this work?
Your Honor, the state is the party here advancing this solution, and the state would be required to work that out. To the extent that, again, the Robinson provides the solution, I think, to your inquiry, the state says that if the exception to the Robinson rule are if the reinstatement remedy adversely affects the ability to prosecute or defend, and that would fall to the state to take care of that matter if it was going to ask for cooperation from another county, if it was going to seek assistance from the state of Minnesota. And if it can't, all we're asking is that it's fair to permit the state the opportunity to do so if it chooses to do so. It's fair, and to the extent it can, then it will prevent these people from driving with these artificially low numbers after they have built up these significant numbers of drunk driving offenses.
Thank you, Ms. Pasek. Thank you, Mr. McKnight, for your arguments this morning, which were very well done, as were your briefs. And that concludes our hearing on 02-2897 and 2898 CR State v. Dowkey. The court is in recess until 1:30.